Metro commuters, your attention please. The next Metro train approaching your station will be a Metro Express train and will not stop.
This is when it starts to get fun. You can hear the game going off in the background. I forgot to put it on silent mode. Welcome to Voices Carry Live. My name is Randy Scott. This is a program for you, and this is your megaphone. This is yours to shout it from the rooftop. Whatever you got, whatever you want to talk about. This is an independent venture from myself to kind of bring some meat and potatoes to our voices. Usually, we've been given this tool on the beautiful double-edged sword of what we call social media, and we feel good by typing stuff in, but it often goes nowhere. That shall change. That is soon changing, and it already is. Yesterday, if you joined me, we went through... Actually, first, we got some weather moving in the area. Let's take a look at the weather bug. Today is January 2nd. We're broadcasting live from the beautiful village of Cary on Rumble X and YouTube. Welcome. Happy New Year. Weather. That's a live look. I saw the snowplow trucks. Whenever I see those yellow flashing lights, I'm in the rearview mirror, I'm like, okay, they're getting ready. There's something coming. And sure enough, every time I look after I see those lights, there's stuff in the distance, the storm. It doesn't look like it's going to be too bad, but at least it'll get some nice, it'll be white. It'll be a white Christmas time. Welcome. If you joined me yesterday, I went through the public water supply loan program and kind of just went through everything. It was interesting to, first of all, the reason why we go through this is to, we all want to have the feeling of that we're involved in the community. We want to know that our everything's going well, everything is projected to be well when our kids move back here. And, you know, I have two kids, one on the way, and we want to position Cary as the home it once was when my parents moved me here. A strong village that bands together and watches after one another, knows our neighbor. And this public water supply loan program has earned a flag. So I'm going to write one down. I do flags just to keep me organized. And to where when the time comes, I can literally, this is some of them, take them all out and start going through the issues, maybe bring it to the people and be like, which one do you want me to tackle first? This one has fast tracked its way up, and I would like to write it out with you right now. Public water. So, if you don't know what I'm talking about, go check out the last show. We kind of went into details on not the actual loan itself. I'm waiting for that right now to return here. But after I went home that night, I kind of did some more digging, and there was some interesting stuff that came up. And the reason why I do this is because I want to know, are we and potentially my kids when they move back here, our kids, us as a village, are we going to have stuff as a burden on our shoulders that somebody else maybe should have footed the bill for? And I feel like doing this research is like And I'm not going around looking for things. It's just, hey, this is coming into the village. I want to take a look at it. And then I go off on, you know, where I find stuff. And the reason why I do it is honestly for you and my family. It's as simple as that. Because decisions can have, this is a 20-year program that could, you know, go transfer generations. So we're going to be looking into that. You'll hear more about it in the following days. And today, since it's a new year, I enjoy history. I enjoy keeping my feet grounded. I think it's more important than ever to have your feet on the ground, especially with technology, especially with all the technology coming in. Like we kind of had the progression of, I'm 36, 37. So I remember going to Circuit City buying our family's first cell phone. So we kind of saw this progression, and it kind of came into our lives gently. Our kids are being raised as if welcome to Earth. We've always had this. So I think it's important to us as residents appreciate history and preserve it, because if we don't do it, other people will, and it's not always in the best interest of the village. So that's why I think it's important to appreciate history, appreciate the folks that settled here and made Cary what it is, and kind of carved out what we appreciate today. This first video is a documentary from the McHenry County Conservation District about the Hollows. There's a farm, the Peachin family had a farm. It's about, I believe it's 8 minutes. But I thought we'd take a look at it together. I haven't watched it fully yet, so we'll watch it together. And if there's anything I can add, I'll write it down and we'll talk about it after. But this is the McHenry County Conservation District's documentary. Enjoy.
Silver Lake Road in Cary, Illinois, holds more than an historic farmhouse. Captured within the 140 acres are memories from three generations who toiled the earth and soils and carved out a living in southeastern McHenry County. Every aspect of the farm, the history, the struggles, and the industrial feats echo through time and serve as a reminder of one of the family's ties to the land that expanded over 135 years. This is the story of the Peachin family. It began in 1871 when Frank Peachin, at the age of 38, and his wife, Antonia Janik, traveled to Barrington Center from their Bohemian homeland with seven children in tow to settle on a farm in Cary, Illinois. Soon after arriving, the Peachin's eldest son, John, needed space of his own, and in 1882, rented some land just a half mile south from a local farmer, Abe Goodwin. And so it came to pass that John Peachin would join a great age of agricultural expansion that embodied the spirit of the Midwest near the turn of the century. Working the fertile Illinois prairie soil, John created a life for himself in the only manner that he knew how, long days filled with hard work and heavy lifting. He married Mary Suki and had two children, Jenny and William. And when Abe Goodwin passed away in 1906, John purchased the entire 120 acres and would later add another 20. Thus, the land became known as the Peachin Family Farm. John's son, William, would eventually become the second Peachin to run the farm. after trying his hand in threshing in the Dakotas and working at the Ekron Tire Factory in Ohio and at a milk factory in Wakanda, William settled down after he met Mary Frances Hasek, whose family owned a tailing store in Chicago. The two married in 1914, and William returned to his farming roots. William's farming practices differed greatly from that of his father's. Where John was old-fashioned, William was industrious and known for using technological advancements to help modernize the farm. It was William who removed many of the older buildings that once stood on the property and expanded the big barn to the east in 1931, and then again to the west in 1939, thus allowing for 50 Holstein cows to be held at a time, as well as a large area for storing hay.
Well, it was just a small center barn. You know, it wasn't big enough. So my dad added on the east side and the west side, you know. It was only half of that one time.
As the farm changed in appearance, so too did the Peachin family. William and Mary had three children, Valerian, Evelyn, and Harry. Although with the passing of time, the faces changed and the farm practices became modernized, the core beliefs that hard work and that enterprising spirit would pay off remained the basic foundation of the Peachin family farm life throughout the generations. The youngest of William's children, Harry, was born in 1922, when the population of Cary totaled just about 750 neighbors. Like his father and grandfather, Harry saw the town change around him and witnessed the population boom after World War II. Life on the farm. Fortunately, when the stock market crash hit in 1929, the Peachins were barely affected. They remained well off during the Depression primarily because their farm had been paid off. They raised their own food and were, for the most part, self-sufficient. By the time World War II came, the government wanted as much production as possible to feed the war effort. This allowed Harry to avoid the draft by being a contributor to home front efforts working the crop fields, as long as he kept the government informed about his farming responsibilities every 3 months. Many farmers benefited from the high prices for commodities caused by the war, and the Peachins were no exception. Just before the onset of the war, William had the foresight to buy a tractor, combine, baler, wagon, and other necessary farming equipment. So during the war years when farming equipment was not being manufactured and was thus scarce and unavailable to many farmers, the Peachins were able to help out their local farmers who went without. During the early 1930s and before the outbreak of World War II, the Peachin raised 1,200 chickens in a two-story structure on the north side of the farmstead. They gathered and sold their eggs and butchered chickens for local restaurants. But during the war, the money to be made was in hogs, because the meat could be more easily preserved and shipped, so the Peachins converted the chicken building into a hog house. Now, during the 1930s and 40s, it was also common for farmers to cooperatively own a threshing ring to cut grain such as wheat, oats, or barley from the stems. The ring was comprised of a threshing machine and a tractor to power it. However, enterprising young William bought his own thresher and custom threshing for other farmers who would pay him per bushel for the service. True to their nature of adopting new technological advances, the Peachins were one of the first farm families to own a hay baler. This advancement greatly increased the amount of hay that could be stored in the barn. Being one of the few farmers in the area with this technology, the Peachins baled hay all over the county from 1941 to 1948. They baled hay for their own use as well as offering some for sale, yet another way for the farm supported its operation. When it came time for the farm to pass through another generation's hands, the job fell to the youngest Peachin, Harry. Much like William, Harry tried his hand at working outside the realm of farming as well. He drove the school bus and did factory work, but he too returned to the farm. In 1949, Harry married Helen Kleps. During this time, while busy attending to his farming responsibilities, Harry also found time to operate rental homes and was avidly involved with real estate, buying and selling as many as 29 properties. Together, he and Helen built three homes between 1949 and 1960, and even furnished them, yet they never moved into any of them. If Helen was disappointed with this, Harry didn't say. However, Harry shared that he never really had any intention of leaving. The connection to the Peachin family farm was much too strong. And to mention the idea of ever breaking up the farm, now that was unthinkable. Harry would get frequent offers from people offering to buy his property for the purpose of subdividing it for housing development, but he always declined. It wasn't until 2007 at the age of 85, that Harry decided to sell the entire 140 acres to McHenry County Conservation District, where the land has now become a part of the larger 478 acres protected within the Hollows Conservation Area, where it would be preserved intact and the stories captured as part of the area's history. The Peachin family knew very well the blood, the dust, and the mud which a farm family faced. It is the kind of toil that very few today can comprehend, let alone be able to endure. However, what comes with that is a connection to the animals, to the community of neighbors, to the land, to live a lifetime on a piece of property, to walk every square foot of its soil, to feel the breezes of the seasons, to know the calls of the songbirds that migrate through, to toil the soils of the earth where your family has left their footprints for over 135 years is what legacies are made of. The land remembers their touch. The neighbors still recall the family name. The memories will be preserved.
Thank you, McHenry County Conservation District, for putting that together. That was beautiful. I enjoyed watching that with you as well. When I see those kids in those photographs, I think of my kids. And I never want my kids to be envious. I don't want them to be green with envy of those kids that they grew up working for their community and working with their hands. And I think it builds character. I think it does a lot of good that trembles down through, as we can see now, and how things are going. It's something that is lost. And I think that's something that people want to get back to. So thank you, McHenry County Conservation District, for keeping those memories alive for us. So we can see those and appreciate them and see where we're going. And then also there was a DVD that's available at the Cary Public Library that is a Cary and Fox River Grove history. This one is a little bit longer. It looks like total is just under about 25 minutes. This is part one of the history of Cary Fox River Grove, and I thought we'd watch it together as well. I enjoy going through this, and I know there's a lot of folks out there that you know, they go through the things we go through with modern life, and it's nothing to be ashamed of looking at how strong our fabric was. And where our community came from. So let's pull this up. Here it is. Enjoy.
Has a unique and colorful history. But what of the town's prehistory? Before and after earliest man arrived on the scene, great natural events took place here to shape the appearance of the land. On first examination, it seems there are no clues to Cary's prehistory, but they are here just the same.
First settlers were the Native Americans, and they settled here because of the Fox River, the prairies, and the woodlands, and its abundant wildlife. I have several pieces that I found in the Cary area. This is the oldest piece, dating back 10,000 BC. I have a piece here that's Marion Thick cord pottery that was authenticated by Dr. Robert Seltzer from Beloit College in Wisconsin. The interesting thing here to archaeologists is that it shows that the Indians didn't come here just for the summer months. They also were here for the winter because this was a large piece of pottery. And that's really a nice piece to have. And it's the largest piece that has been found in McHenry County. Okay, well, I have some scrapers that they scrape the hide. I have an axe, an old axe. This was like a hammer stone, used like we would use a hammer today. There were some that were used for balls. The Indians did play games, marbles, a wonderful knife. This piece was my most recent find, and this was just found on the down on the river banks just like a couple of weeks ago. It's just the piece at the bottom, but you could see where the hide was tied around here real tight. Another interesting piece that was found just recent was I first found this piece this spring after a rain. If you go after a rain, it's interesting because things will come up. For instance, if a motorcycle has ridden along a trail, they will pop up. And then the next couple of days, I found the other piece to this, which is really amazing. I've got some tiny, tiny little pieces from probably that the Indians did when for the children, for something for them to do. And to me, the most awesome thing is to think and hold something like this and think, 10,000 years ago, someone worked and made this piece, and I'm holding it today.
Native Americans, pioneers, farmers, and entrepreneurs have all contributed to the area's rich heritage. Early settlers in Cary and Fox River Grove were drawn by affordable land and an opportunity to start a farm on which their families could subsist.
My grandfather was born in the Czech Republic, and he came to Fox River Grove in 1903. He was a businessman in Chicago in the wood business, and Mr. O'Patterney, who had the picnic grove, was a friend of his, and he came out one day and he said, "Joe, why don't you buy this farm over here?" So my grandfather, in 1903, paid $8,500 cash for an 80-acre farm in Fox River Grove that consisted of 20 cows, 3 horses, some chickens, and some machinery. My grandmother was furious. He was a man who was probably a woodman, was getting involved in being a farmer. The farm ran between River Road and Grove Avenue from the river to the new school, and that was the Vorasek Farm.
The Harper family came to Cary by Ross's Bridge. My folks bought a land out there from the Rawson Farm, or it wasn't that name, but Nellie Thompson owned the land, and we bought lots from him and my father. The first year, we camped in a tent, and then my father, that summer, was building a garage, two-car garage. So by the next year, we had a two-car garage to live in, and then my father started on the house. And but we only used it for a summer home, but we were out here almost as much in Cary that we were in Chicago. We were all born in Chicago. And we liked to ski and ice skate, and the boys liked to hunt and fish. And so every time we had a chance to come out here, we came to Cary.
While no known photos exist of William Denison Cary, we know that he was born in 1808 in Sandy Creek, New York. He first purchased land in this area in 1841 and platted Cary Station in 1856. Mr. Cary built a two-story red brick home at 9 West Main Street in 1845. Today, the home's actual address is 2 East Ross Street. William Denison Cary died in 1861. He did not see the Civil War end.
My husband was a direct descendant of Cary, and they came here as settlers from the East. I have an original, what they would call a blanket chest, that was brought over by covered wagon. I have that, and that was in the 1800s. Luna Mensch was the first school teacher and principal in Cary. And the building, of course, is now known as Windridge Funeral Chapel. It was one room. All the children were in this particular building. I have the original bell. And you have to realize that back then, the children were from grade 1 to 8, but also the fact that when harvesting time came, or planting, a lot of the children had to work in the fields, so then they would miss school and come back the next season and repeat. Sometimes the children were 16 and 17 years old. This belongs to William D. Cary's first child. It's a christening dress, all handmade, the tatting, everything. These are the little gloves that were worn, most unusual for today. and the little kid slippers and this hat here is all hand tatted. Now this is 1847. This is the original teacher's register book where Mr. Luna Minch kept the records of department, attendance, and what have you. And this is the original school bell.
As the 19th century gave way to the 20th, the people of Cary and Fox River Grove shared many rich and colorful experiences and saw much change through the good deeds of the famous and the misdeeds of the infamous.
Then, of course, the crash came in October of 29. So things were very tough in Cary in the 30s, and we were a very poor town, very, very poor. There was no place to work for my father and the rest of them. The only three places in town to work were the Northwood Mink Farm, Hertz Farm, and a few people worked at Frankie Lumberyard. My dad, fortunately, worked for Mr. Hertz, who was a very, very tough man to work for. He had his homes here in Cary. He had homes all over. He was the fifth richest man in the world, and not just in the United States, in the world. He made his money, he started the yellow taxi cab. He painted a couple cars yellow in Chicago and started with that. By 1936 or 37, he owned Studebaker, he owned TWA, he owned the Arlington Racetrack. He won the Kentucky Derby with Ray Count in the late 20s or early 30s, and Ray Count's stable is still up here on in Trout Valley.
Mr. Hertz was quite a celebrity when he came into Cary, and he bought the land, which is now known as Trout Valley. And he raised horses, which were ended up to be quite famous in the Kentucky Derby and things like that. He had many celebrities come out here. And of course, one of his sons married Myrna Loy, which was quite a thing for Cary to have a movie star.
The River Bend has a long, colorful history. Even though we moved here in 48, that was probably the first year it was really a restaurant. Prior to that, it was simply a bar. In fact, in the 20s, more popularly known as a speakeasy, where all the mob members from Chicago would come out and play. This was their playground in McHenry County. This was secluded in a gravel road out in the middle of nowhere. It was a small, square little bar, but the inside was filled with slot machines. In fact, I have worked with a lady many years ago who did tell me she came here as a teenager. She described the bar to me, and the slot machines were everywhere, in the basement, in the foyer, in the bathrooms, in fact.
The Grove was kind of a resort town. It was known for being a playground area. There were always big picnics coming on Sundays in the summertime in the Picnic Grove. And you couldn't cross Lincoln Avenue in those days unless the policeman was blocked traffic. And of course, in those days, there was a lot of gambling in the colony. I can remember we had slot machines in the grocery stores and the restaurants. And our favorite, we also had one in the drugstore. And we'd come home from a scout meeting or somewhere, we'd put our nickels and dimes in the machine and hope we have a windfall.
One time, it could have been in the 40s, the Bill Washer, who was on maybe 15 or 12 Spring Street, he had Washer's Tavern, and they had slot machines and so forth. And some of the gangs from Chicago, I guess, wanted to get part of it or do something. But anyway, they threw a bomb through the front window of his place and blew most of the windows out of all these first block here in Cary. It was late at night, and so nobody got hurt.
On the corner of Lincoln and Route 14 was kind of a big entertainment center for adults. There was a dance hall pavilion and a tavern called Louis Place. The dance pavilion was also a place where they had wrestling matches. And I recall as a young boy in the 30s going to those wrestling matches. And two of the local heroes were Jack Sperling and Ray Riswald. Now in the tavern downstairs, once I got to see what was known as the famous tunnels. There were two big white doors down there. And they opened up one door and showed my dad and myself the tunnels, which led somewhere back into the residential area. How far they led, I do not know. They might have been 100 feet, they might have been 20 feet, I do not know. but they led back somewhere into the residential area of town, which will allow an escape for a bootlegger.
A lot of hoodlums and so forth came to Cary in the late 30s and 40s. Just about a half a mile from where we're talking, they raided a truck one night on the Z curve up here and took all their booze away from them. There was a still up by the corner of Three Oaks Road and 14 just across the highway that was raided when I was in about fourth or fifth grade. And they didn't catch the guys that were doing the stilling because they had a tunnel out from the barn out into the cornfield. They got away from them. But they wrecked the still, of course, and everything. And then down on Hickory Nut Grove Road, right near where I live, was the Lyons farm, and he was always had his fingers in of a lot of things. And he had a barn there, and my dad always told me the story that they would go there from John Hurt's farm to buy some horses from him. And he had a blind horse, and that horse would run down the middle of the barn, and he knew where to swerve because there was a hole in the barn floor where the still was hid underneath. And they never did catch him, though, but he was a big one in it. And then, of course, in the early 40s, Roger Toohey, they were chasing him, and they thought they had him cornered in Fox River Grove with Cernakis, but there also was a tunnel out of there. It's right on the corner of where the stoplights are in the Grove. There was a big dance hall there, and he got away from them. I never seen so many state police in one town. And then Babyface Nelson got it when they went after Al Capone up in, not Al Capone, John Dillinger up in Wisconsin. They all scattered, and Babyface Nelson got caught right outside of Barrington on the curve there. And my dad used to show me the gun marks in the tree where they'd gunned them down. There were some thrilling times.
While some of Chicago's most notorious crime figures made the Cary Grove area their playground, so did many of the country's most prominent business leaders and philanthropists.
Well, my great-grandparents came here and purchased some land. I think it was from the Indians. And as time went on, my grandfather bought the land from his father and encouraging people to come out to Fox River Grove. And he had a picnic grove, a hotel, and a dance pavilion. And he would have all these picnics in the picnic grove. And he had a surveyor come out and start laying out some property and encourage people to come out and buy these to start Fox River Grove.
Well, it goes back to my father-in-law, Louis Cernaki, and his mother and father. They came out and had a restaurant in Fox River Grove. A very nice restaurant, very good food, good bohemian food, dumplings, sauerkraut, duck, everything. And they had a dance hall with a great big, all I heard about was this big, big chandelier, crystal chandelier. Supposed to have been just beautiful. Maybe you saw it.
Yeah, I saw it.
Just beautiful. And of course, my father-in-law worked for them. And then afterwards, after he and my mother-in-law were married, they had a liquor business. And then they bought the property from the Grandma Patterny, and we ran the picnic grove, which was in 42.
Yeah.
And from those picnics, they went into Seaburg, jukeboxes, the gas company. We had large groups. Bell and Howell, a lot of big, big companies.
That was part one. That is a DVD that's available at the Cary Public Library. A lot of cool history. Some little scandalous, some a little nostalgic. Yeah, it looks like some folks made Cary their playground. I knew of some that happened off of Hickory Nut Grove Road, but they went into a lot there. Let's watch part two here. It's 12 minutes, and let's pull it up. Okay, enjoy.
parents came over from Sweden in probably the late 20s, and they were people that worked as servants, and they worked for the president of the Continental Illinois National Bank in Chicago. And then my mom was a waitress, and she worked around the house, and it was the housekeeper, and my dad was the chauffeur. And then they moved to Libertyville. And then the people that started the Curtis Candy Company, Otto Schnering, he invented the Baby Ruth and the Butterfinger candy bar, they bought the estate in Libertyville. And so my parents moved with the Schnerings out to Cary in the early 40s. And our family grew up there. And I grew up at the Center Gate House in Trout Valley, and it was the right side. My dad was in charge of the raising of the turkeys and the chickens and the ducks. And so they had probably maybe 500,000 chickens, and they would raise them for maybe 6-7 weeks, and they would ship them off to restaurants and all over. And that's the reason that Turkey Hill was named, because my dad used to raise turkeys up there. And my mom had a big vegetable garden up there by Turkey Hill, too. And it was kind of cool because we didn't have any money, but you're raised in an atmosphere, a very affluent atmosphere, because you would have like free swimming lessons, free horseback riding lessons. And my dad, when he was in charge of chickens, I used to ride with him and see how they were butchered. And they used to do that in Wheeling. So I remember one day I had pink eye and I didn't get to go to school. So I went over there and I watched how they butchered the chickens. And they had Japanese people in those days that did it. And it would come, they would just put the chicken on a rotating thing, and then one guy would slit the throat, and then it would go on, and it would dip it in hot water, and all the feathers would come out, and then all of a sudden they would come out clean on the other end. And they always had huge parties, and you'd go through this big, big room, and they had this walk-in closet that was about maybe half the size of this room, and it would be full of just all this food for parties. And then you go through the dining room, and they'd have a buzzer on the floor, so when you had to go in and serve, they'd ring the buzzer, and my mom would go in there, and it was a beautiful marble floor that was so shiny with, they had huge sterling silver like coffee pots and big dishes. They'd have the turkeys on it, all be sterling silver. And then when you walk down, there was a huge living room, was all hand-carved with balconies, and that burned down eventually. It turned into Villa Des, and that burned down. And Mrs. Schnering, every Christmas, she would get a huge Christmas tree, and it would be about 40 feet tall. It would be all the way to the ceiling, and she'd have ladders and decorate all the Christmas trees. And then once a year, up at the bull barn, they'd have a party for all the kids that lived on the farm. And we would all sing Christmas carols, and we would all practice even for a few days before that. And every child would come up to the top, to the front, and Santa Claus would be there, and they would call their names, and we would all get Christmas presents from the Schnerings. So it was a good way to be brought up.
Mr. Hurd came actually to Cary in about 1920. When they first moved out here, they had to live in the, well, it was a farmhouse, Levi's farmhouse, Levi Smith's farmhouse. But there wasn't any place else still on the property, so they lived in there until he bought the had to build this beautiful 30-room house. And then it just kept going and going, and the horses were so wonderful and doing good. And finally, he won the Count Fleet. The first one was Ray Count. He won the Kentucky Derby. And then in 1928, though, Count Fleet, that's his son, won the Kentucky Derby, but also went on to win the Triple Crown. And that was a big, by the way, when Ray Count won, and they brought him by here by train, and he got off the train, everybody in town had a big parade and, you know, waving stuff for Ray Count. And those were good times around here.
The Norgi Ski Club was established in 1905. It was Norwegian immigrants that wanted a place to ski jump, since they were the first ski jumpers in apparently ever. They started the whole idea of the ski jumping. They were primarily based in Chicago at that time, but they needed a place to build a jump and have a good hill. And Fox River Grove had that. We have our large jump is what's called a 60-meter hill. Generally, we don't have too many children, you know, small children going off of that. But last year, I think it was about three children that were
12-year-olds.
About 12-year-old that went off, and we were very proud of that fact.
Their mothers were terrified, but everybody else was proud, yes.
Very proud that we had three 12-year-olds going off the big hill. Not for competition, but they did go off. Back in the early days, we used to get 30,000 people out there for a tournament. Although a lot of those people came on the train. There's an interesting story about the trains back in the early days. That was before Fox River Grove was a town. They used to come on the train from Chicago, and as they hit close to the Fox River, they would roll out their barrel of beer, and then they'd stop in Cary and walk back, pick up the beer and bring it on over to the club grounds. Speaking of the Norwegian influence, I brought this hat along. A member had one similar to this, and they brought it to a meeting one night, and this gentleman wanted all the board members to wear these Norwegian helmets. Even though these are really mythical things, they really never fought with these kind of helmets. This gentleman brought it to the meeting, and they passed it around, and everybody put it on their head. And some of the ladies looked very, very silly in that. But when they got to me, they said, "Oh, Marty, you look great in that." So I'm kind of like the Norwegian mascot. If you come out to the ski tournament, you'll see me running around in the costume with this outfit and a big furry cape and just
kind of a skirt thing that a lot of girls want to know what's under.
Kind of greeting people
like
and saying
shorts.
Hello, and a lot of people really enjoy seeing me in costume that day.
In the year approximately 1900, Cary started cutting ice to supply the town of Cary and the local towns, I suppose. But they only had the horsepower on the river because they had to wait till the ice was thick enough to cut, which was maybe, I would say maybe a foot, 18 inches. And then they would take this one piece here that looks like a plow out of a farm, but it's not. It's like a big saw, and that would be for scoring the ice. And they would lay it out with some chalk line or something first. And then they would score the ice, and this plow-looking piece of equipment was pulled with a horse and a one man behind it. But all the ice in those days came from the Fox River, and that's what you put in your ice box, and that's what you chipped off if you wanted to make ice cubes for your drinks or whatever. Everybody was drinking ice from the Fox River, which was a very clean river at that time.
Northwood Fur Farm had a fine reputation for selling some of the finest mink pelts in the entire world. It was the largest mink ranch in the United States in the late 50s and 60s. You might say it had its heyday. There were over 100,000 pens with mink in them. It was financed by a New York cartel, even though it was owned by the Otto Gross family.
Well, Otto Gross, of course, had the mink farm, and periodically he would give fashion shows. And there would be famous models that would come out, model these beautiful, beautiful coats and jackets and stoles and things like that. And they would make quite a big thing out of it. They'd have they would serve food on these beautiful tables with parasols and tablecloths. It was just wonderful.
Winston Churchill said, "Kites rise highest against the wind, not with it." The courageous ancestors of families like Cary, Mensch, Cernocki, O'Patterney, and so many others surely would have appreciated the meaning behind those words. It was their collective vision that formed our past and paved our future. The Cary Fox River Grove area we know today is comprised of two vibrant, thriving communities. Communities which have surely undergone dramatic change over the years, but which have also managed to preserve their sense of place.
There you go. I let that play out because I think it's important to keep these things alive as in many places as possible. It's good to put these things in everywhere you can, because if it's just on one source, I got the inspiration for this megaphone. You're probably asking, like, why is this an old megaphone? I got the inspiration for this megaphone from a movie called Book of Eli. It's a great movie. It's Denzel Washington. Do not look it up before you watch it. But there was a group of folks that had a community within that movie, and they controlled information. They controlled history. They controlled what folks knew. And I remember I moved to Cary when I was 3, and I remember going to... I went to Three Oaks Elementary School back when it was a kindergarten through sixth grade. Had an amazing time there, and I still have many fond memories of that. And right next door to Three Oaks School, before the library was there, was, and even across the street, was along Three Oaks Road there, right before the soccer fields, was a farm and a farmhouse, and they used to sell hay. They used to sell hay there, and they would put it out on a farm trailer, and it would be an honor system. They would have hay, and then they'd have pumpkins in the fall, and they'd have some other knickknacks and stuff, and it'd be on the honor system. They'd have a box, like a metal box. I can still see it today. And there was a reflector on it. It's amazing what you remember. But the box, it was the honor system, and you'd put money and your change in there, and then you'd take what you purchased. The reason why I'm doing this is because if my kids, we're obviously growing up in a different time. And I'm not against technology. I'm not saying that we should all become farmers. I'm just saying some of the values have been lost. Some of the pride and ethics have been lost in translation over the years. And if when my kids get old enough and they start poking around and they're like, what once was? Because right now we're living in it. We're living in pretty much like no privacy. And it runs deep. And if my kids go, when they get older, and they're like, were things ever different? And then they decide to start a podcast to try to make change, it's going to be a hell of a lot harder for them to preserve and get back to a community and a village of where we have a say, a village to where we have pride and ownership, to where we don't feel like we're just one of many, where we empower each other. We're in the know. And I can see that all coming. I can see it coming to where it's not just Carrie. It's pretty much no matter where they will go, they'll have that burden of how do we roll this back and get back to our roots, to where we're not just in our screens all day and consuming. So that's what I'm doing here. It's a frontal assault against those that wish otherwise. It's about community. It's about you. And I enjoy every single second of it. And it's gonna get fun. Coming up on the next few months, and I look forward to it. Thank you for joining me today and watching that. I enjoy watching that that history with you. We got to see a whole grab bag full of things from our local history, and it's nice to share it, and it's nice if. You know, even though, you know, I'm not breaking record numbers with viewership. Who knows who will see this one day, or will see this and want to share it. That gets that inkling of like, yeah, something needs to be done. And this is your place to do it. Thank you for joining me today on Voices Carry Live. We broadcast live to Rumble X and YouTube, and let's see if the cat thing's up. It is. Success. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll have a Friday show, maybe some current happenings, and I look forward to it. Have a wonderful evening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
You're confirmed at T-minus 10 seconds.
In counting, 10, 9, 8... 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Reach for the sky.
Huh?
This town ain't big enough for the two of us.
What?
Somebody's poisoned the water hole.
It's busted.
Who are you calling busted, Buster? That's right. I'm talking to you, Sid Phillips. We don't like being blown up, Sid. Or smashed, or ripped apart.
We?
That's right, your toys.
Thank you. play nice.